Our New Testament reading is from the book of Acts, chapter 18. After this, Paul left Athens and went to Corinth, and he found a Jew named Aquila, a native of Pontus, recently come from Italy with his wife Priscilla, because Claudius had commanded all the Jews to leave Rome. And he went to see them, and because he was of the same trade, he stayed with them and worked, for they were tent makers by trade. And he reasoned in the synagogue every Sabbath and tried to persuade Jews and Greeks. When Silas and Timothy arrived from Macedonia, Paul was occupied with the word, testifying to the Jews that the Christ was Jesus. And when they opposed and reviled him, he shook out his garments and said to them, "Your blood be on your own heads. I am innocent. From now on, I will go to the Gentiles." And he left there and went to the house of a man named Titius Justus, a worshiper of God. His house was next door to the synagogue. Crispus, the ruler of the synagogue, believed in the Lord together with his entire household. And many of the Corinthians, hearing Paul, believed and were baptized. And the Lord said to Paul one night in a vision, "Do not be afraid, but go on speaking and do not be silent, for I am with you, and no one will attack you to harm you, for I have many in this city who are my people." And he stayed a year and 6 months, teaching the word of God among them. But when Gallio was proconsul of Achaia, the Jewish religious leaders made a united attack on Paul and brought him before the tribunal, saying, "This man is persuading people to worship God contrary to the law." But when Paul was about to open his mouth, Gallio said to the Jews, "If it were a matter of wrongdoing or vicious crime, O Jews, I would have reason to accept your complaint. But since it is a matter of questions about words and names and your own law, see to it yourselves. I refuse to be judge of these things." And he drove them from the tribunal. And they all seized Sosthenes, the ruler of the synagogue, and beat him in front of the tribunal. But Gallio paid no attention to any of this. The word of the Lord.
Good morning, everyone. My mic is on. Awesome. It really is a privilege to be with you all. Thank you, Dean, for your kind invitation. It's always a bit tricky when someone, you know, kind of sets you up a certain way, then you have to deliver, you know. Hopefully that we'll be able to do that. But it really is lovely to be with you. I've been, in preparation for being with you today, I've been going online and listening to some of the previous talks and so on, so I feel like I've already been here a little bit before arriving today. Thank you for the kind words about Regent College. It is a wonderful place and a beautiful community to be a part of, and I'd be happy to chat with any of you who would like to talk about that at any point. But what I'm really here to do today is to talk about Paul arriving in Corinth. And I'm a New Testament scholar. I'm a bit of a history nerd. So it's going to feel like a history lesson today. But ask the Lord to give you something that will have real application to yourself. A couple of weeks ago, I understand you were talking about Paul in Athens. So you've started on this journey of Paul traveling through the Aegean world, and today Paul has traveled 30 or 40 miles, or 65 I think it is now that I look at it, 65 miles to the west, about 3 or 4 days walking from Athens, and he's arrived in Corinth. And this is a very significant place in the history of the early church, in the book of Acts, and in the life of Paul. The central part of Paul's ministry and active work was centered on Corinth. Lots of things happened in Corinth, and so it's really great that we have an opportunity to think about what was happening in the city, what God was doing in the city, how God prepared the people there for the work that was to unfold. Corinth was a wealthy place. It was a port city. It had a reputation for wealth, but also for vice. There was a word in ancient Greek times, which was to Corinthianize, which was not a kind of word that you would want to have applied to you. To live like a Corinthian was not seen as a particularly good thing. But, you know, so a typical city full of all kinds of things going on, both good and bad. Corinth was a Roman colony, which meant that it had a particular kind of status. In the Roman Empire, not all the cities were Roman colonies. Some of them were more cities under domination. They were client cities. They were cities of, it's a very structured world with people at high status and low status. But Corinth was a Roman colony, which, like Philippi, which you, did you cover Philippi as well? You haven't done Philippi? Well, there's another story that happens in a Roman colony, and there's some points of comparison between the two. It's a place that became very important in the life and ministry of Paul, and Paul, over the years of his association with the city, would develop quite a complex relationship with the Corinthians. He stayed there quite a long time, as we saw in our reading. 18 months, we're told about, at least that long on his first visit. But after he had left, Paul stayed in contact with the Corinthians and visited them several times over the course of the next few years, and he wrote letters to them. And that's a critical part of the whole Corinthian story, because two of the longest letters that we have in the New Testament are Paul's correspondence back to the Corinthians, and you find in those letters that they were writing to him as well, although we don't have copies of those letters anymore. But there's an ongoing relationship between Paul and the Corinthians, and some of the most important and famous parts of the New Testament are in that correspondence. Like, perhaps the most famous passage is 1 Corinthians chapter 13, which is that wonderful ode to love which may have been read at your wedding. If you cast your mind back to celebration of love. But there's lots of other really important teaching in the Corinthian correspondence as well, on things like spiritual gifts and the nature of the resurrection and the ministry of reconciliation and so many other wonderful things. So when we come to the Corinthian letters, which we're not doing today, but just to have those in the back of our mind, they are sparkling with drama. There's all kinds of life and dynamism in that correspondence. It's like reading someone else's mail, it's, you know, there's that kind of excitement that you might have when you read someone else's mail, especially if it's mail that's got all kinds of controversy and dynamic interactions going on in them. So those letters give us a wonderful glimpse into the life of the early church. And they reveal to us that Paul's relationship with the Corinthians was anything but smooth and straightforward. In fact, that community caused Paul huge heartache, amazing headaches, and it went both ways. I think that Paul was a difficult guy to be around. He was, I think, quite demanding, but he had brilliant insights given to him by the Holy Spirit about what it meant to be the people of God and what God was doing in the world. And so all of that makes this part of the New Testament so important to us. And here in Acts chapter 18, we have this wonderful thing that is given to us, which is the founding story of the gospel and the church in Corinth. There's many other communities that became important in the early church for which we do not have anything like this. But here we've got this marvelous insight into how things began in this really important part of God's work. And here we get a kind of first-generation early insight into how the gospel was being preached once it overflowed the land of Jerusalem and Judea and Galilee where the gospel started. Here we see an example of the gospel taking root in other parts of the world, where the gospel is flowing out to the wider world in fulfillment of the Great Commission. Here we have an early instance of how the gospel began to take root in all of these other communities around the Mediterranean world. And so I want to go through this passage just very briefly this morning and just touch on some of the details of the story. As a historian myself, I find this passage to be packed with interesting nuggets of information on just about every sentence. Every line has got something of importance or significance for us. And as we go through the story, I want you to think about what are the implications for us? What are the implications for you in your situation and the work you do in the community that you're a part of? It's not always about finding applications, like how do I apply this to myself? It's more, when you're reading a story in the Bible, to think about what are the kind of trajectories or what follows from this? What might be something that I can take from this that derives from this story? It's not always a direct application, but it's kind of thinking about if that happened then in those days to them, what might happen to us now in our time here? So I invite you to have that kind of spirit as you think about this, as you hear what I have to say. And I know that many of you have studied this passage and maybe even are studying it now. So you can compare your, have your own notes in your mind about what has struck you about this passage as you've looked at it in the past. So here's just some kind of highlights that I have found very interesting and I think that have real connection for us. So let's just dive into the passage and see how it goes. So first point that I noticed that when Paul arrived in Corinth, he met a Jewish couple called Aquila and Priscilla. And it's interesting, I think, to notice that it says that Paul sought them out. He went looking for them. So apparently he knew them or he had heard about them. We don't know that backstory, but there was perhaps some connection. And perhaps they were already, it seems as if they were already Christians and were already a part of the Christian movement. And they had the same trade that Paul had. They were makers of tents. The tents, we don't know exactly what they were made of, but possibly leather tents, possibly linen tents, probably awnings that were used in marketplaces and so on, and perhaps used by travelers, like people like Paul and Priscilla and Aquila. And so it was an important trade that could be used in lots of different places, and they had the same trade, and Paul sought them out, and they joined forces, and they would become a part of Paul's team. Like Paul, they were travelers. They were natives. We're told Aquila was a native of Pontus. Do you know where Pontus is, Dean? It's in Turkey on the shore of the Black Sea. So it's a far, it's a long way from Corinth. And so they've already traveled a long way to be in Corinth. But they haven't come directly from Pontus. It says that they have just arrived from Italy. In fact, they're there because the Jewish community has been expelled from Rome. Rome is 1,000 miles to the west of Corinth. So that immediately makes me think about, just this reminds me of how the Mediterranean world was a sphere of economic activity and of travel and of people crisscrossing back and forth around this whole sphere. So there's a lot going on, and Paul and his companions are by no means the only people who are on journeys. Right, so you've got to think about a world that's very active. There's a lot of people crisscrossing in all directions. Paul and his missionary activity just kind of fit into that world of economic travel, of people going all over the place. And Priscilla and Aquila would join forces with Paul, and when Paul left a year and a half later, or a couple of years later, to go to Ephesus, Priscilla and Aquila would go with him, and they would help him to set up his operation in Ephesus. And while Priscilla and Aquila were in Ephesus, before Paul arrived, they met another important traveling Christian called Apollos, who himself had just arrived from another faraway place, Alexandria in Egypt. So now the picture of the traveling of this early community gets even wider. And then after being in Ephesus, Apollos would leave and come to Corinth. And when Paul would write to the Corinthians, he would refer to Apollos. So I want us to have a picture of a wide network of people traveling in all directions, and how the Christian message is being carried by people that we don't know much about. Because when Apollos arrived from Alexandria in Ephesus, he was already preaching the gospel. So how did he learn about the gospel? How did the story arrive in Alexandria? Well, we don't know, but it happened, and people were preaching the gospel in all directions. So that tells us that the story that we have about the early church in the book of Acts is just a fraction of the story. That we've got a narrow focus on a particularly important group of people, Paul and Peter and other named people like that. But there's always something going on outside the peripheral vision, as it were. We're looking at something here, but there's lots of other things that are happening. The gospel is spreading, and there's more going on than we can see directly, and as we're told about here. And so just think about, we've just been through Pentecost Sunday. Think about all of those people who were present in Jerusalem on the day of Pentecost when the Spirit arrived and so many people came to faith. And over the next weeks, where all of those people were converted and came into the church. And think of all the places that they came from and to which they would have returned. Can you remember some of the places that are mentioned in the beginning of the book of Acts? Places like Parthia, which is modern-day Iran, and Mesopotamia, modern-day Iraq, Cappadocia, central Turkey, Pontus, where Aquila was from, Egypt, where Apollos was from, Libya in North Africa, where Simon of Cyrene was from, and of course, Rome and Arabia, and there's other places as well. All of those places were represented there by people on the day of Pentecost. So by the time that Paul arrived in Corinth, the spreading of the gospel was already underway in all directions. And one of the things that we can imagine about that is that it led to a bit of chaos. This wasn't an orderly, kind of easy progress of the gospel spreading in all directions. And so Paul's work, his pastoral work, is often about dealing with the wild craziness of all of these people coming to faith in different settings, bringing their own assumptions and presumptions and thoughts about what does it mean that Jesus is raised from the dead and God is ushering in a new age in the world. And we know even from Apollos being in Ephesus that he had to be taught stuff by Priscilla and Aquila because he didn't adequately understand the gospel yet. And so Paul's experience was about kind of not only preaching the gospel to people who were hearing it for the first time, but also managing this environment with so many things going on in all directions. So there's lots of complexity. Something else that I find very important in the story is the glimpse that it gives us of the role of women in Paul's movement. Because Priscilla turns out to be an important person. And even though Aquila is mentioned first in this story, in this moment, but every other time that Priscilla is mentioned in the book of Acts, her name is said before Aquila. It's Priscilla and Aquila. Priscilla and Aquila in Ephesus, Priscilla and Aquila back in Corinth, and then even in Paul's letter to the Romans, he mentions Priscilla and Aquila, which is a suggestion that actually in this highly hierarchical world of the Roman Empire, Priscilla had a higher social status than her husband. It may well be that he hired up in the social sort of layers of society. And she, it looks like, was the significant person who led the way in teaching Apollos when the time came for that. It says that they taught Apollos the way of God more adequately. And Priscilla was by no means the only woman in Paul's movement. There's other women that are mentioned, like Phoebe from Kenchrea. Kenchrea, mentioned right after this passage that we've been looking at, but also in Paul's letter to the Romans, Paul references Phoebe from Kenchrea. The reason why that's significant is because Kenchrea is the port of Corinth, and Phoebe is Paul's patron. She becomes a benefactor. She is probably a wealthy merchant herself, and she is bankrolling Paul's mission. You've got to think there's got to be money for this thing. You can't travel around the world without cash and without backers and donors and patrons and supporters. And Phoebe was that kind of a person. And Paul would send her from Corinth ahead of himself to Rome so that by the time he arrived in Rome, there was already the beginnings of a base there because Paul wanted to go from Rome to Spain. So Paul's plans weren't just based on a kind of a whim and a prayer. There's planning, there's logistics, there's people, and Phoebe was one of the key people. There's also a person called Chloe mentioned in 1 Corinthians. Chloe also seems to have been a merchant or a trader, and she has an entourage of people that are traveling back and forth between Corinth and Ephesus, bringing Paul reports about stuff that's going on. And of course, there's Lydia in chapter 16, who is described as a seller of purple, which means that she is a trader in luxury goods, and she is one of the first people to have come to faith in Europe. Certainly in the story of the book of Acts, she's the first person to be mentioned that way. And then in Thessalonica and Berea, just places that Paul has just been in, the narrative specifically refers to leading women in those communities who were drawn into Paul's mission and into those communities. So sometimes we can think, sometimes people who read the letters of Paul think that he was anti-women or that he was misogynistic, which I think is just completely belied by this story, which shows women being drawn into the message that Paul was preaching. They found the story to be liberating and whole-making, and they were drawn into the story, and we see that happening in this case with Priscilla and Aquila. So are you with me? Do you need to take a stretch? We're in the middle of a lecture here. So the next thing to notice in this story is the importance of synagogues. Paul came to a synagogue in Corinth, and that is where he started his operation, in that city. That's the first place of call. And this was Paul's missional practice. As a Jew himself, of course, all the first Christians were themselves Jews. The gospel was given to the Jews, and it flowed out from Jerusalem to the rest of the world. And that reminds us, remember, of the Great Commission that was given in the beginning of the book of Acts, that you will be witnesses in Jerusalem and Judea and Samaria and to the ends of the world. And that became a pattern for Paul's operations, that he would go to each new town, to the synagogue first of all. And we have examples in the book of Acts of Paul preaching to Jews. The fullest example of that is in Acts chapter 13, where Paul is in Lystra, and he outlines how Jesus is the fulfillment of the narrative of God's dealing with his people, the people of Israel down through ages, from the patriarchs to the time of David, and Christ is the fulfillment of that story. In Acts chapter 17, which you looked at a little while ago, there's an example of Paul preaching to Gentiles. And there you can see he has a different approach. There his approach is focused on God as the ruler of the universe and how Christ is the judge who stands at the end of time waiting for each person to give an account for their life. So Paul was able to adjust his message to each setting that he was in. But he started with the synagogues. He started with the Jewish community. And it made sense for him to do that, not only because that was the commission that had been given, but because the synagogues constituted a ready-made network of people. There was a Jewish diaspora, Jewish communities spread throughout the Mediterranean world in which people had been raised in the scriptures. They knew the books of Moses. They knew the Psalms. They read from the Psalms in the Sabbath each week. And those communities were the natural place for Paul to start his work. And so we see the importance of networks and family connections. And it's wonderful to look at some of the names that emerge from this, because in the end, it's not just about kind of processes, it's about people. Along the way of Paul's travels, he picked up individuals like Timothy, for example. In the south central town of Lystra, Timothy would become a significant part of Paul's network and the work that he did. And two letters in the New Testament, of course, are written to him. But there's other names that we just are given a glimpse of, like Crispus, the synagogue leader who's mentioned here in Acts chapter 18. Now, interestingly, Crispus is mentioned also in 1 Corinthians as one of the people that Paul baptized. So it's wonderful to see the connection. Someone who's mentioned in Acts 18 is mentioned again later when Paul talks about, when he reflects back on this time that he was in Corinth. And there's another synagogue leader that's mentioned here in our Acts 18 passage. This person by the name of Sosthenes, who's a synagogue leader and seems to have been one of the people who brought the accusation against Paul. Because when the court case is thrown out, it says that the mob beat him up, which is a little bit of an insight into the way justice was done in the Roman Empire. You go to a tribunal and you make your case. If it goes against you, the local crowd who are there just for entertainment might just, you know, punch you up a bit. So you wouldn't take a court case lightly. And here you've got this person called Sosthenes getting beaten up in front of Gallio, the Roman proconsul, and the Roman does nothing about it. Remarkably, there's a person called Sosthenes at the beginning of 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 1, where Paul, far away in Ephesus, writes from him, he says, from Paul and Sosthenes, our brother. Is it the same guy? It's got to be the same guy. How many Sosthenes do you know? So that's another remarkable piece of this story, that people are coming to faith sometimes outside the central narrative of the story, but the gospel is growing, and there's this network of people and connections and friendships. And all the way through Paul's letters and the book of Acts, there are names. And it's easy for us to just jump over those names, but I love to pause on them and just to think about them as real people. Think about the people that you know who are significant, people in your life who are a part of the gospel, who are serving the Lord in ways that are known and unknown, big and small. And Paul's community was made up of people like that. Some of these people were hosts of churches. Some of them traveled with Paul for a while. They're all a part of this amazing network of friends and associates who made up what we call the early church. The communion of God's people, the communion of saints, you can speak theologically, who in a way are a instantiation, a kind of representation of the communion that is in God himself, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. The community of God's people is made up of all of these individuals. And so I like to think about the importance of networks. And I just think about that in my own life, the people that I know from all around the world. In fact, me being here today is because I know Dean from Vancouver, which is a long way away. And Dean and I have a fellow friend from South Africa. I'm from South Africa. Tony's from South Africa. There's kind of connections that overflow. And I can look, there's Mike over there who's from Regina, Saskatchewan of all places. And I know him and his family from there. And you can all do that as well. You can think of people that you know that are part of the church, part of kingdom work. And that is how God is accomplishing his work all around the world. And it's been like that from the beginning. Now, there's one particular kind of demographic within this network that's particularly interesting. And that is the reference to God-fearers. Because it's not just Jews in these synagogues. There are Gentiles at the synagogues too, which is fascinating, isn't it? You know, we sometimes think of this clear break between Jews and synagogues and everyone else somewhere else. But there was already, in these days, in the time of the diaspora of the Jewish community, we've got people who are referred to as God-fearers. These are people who have already been attracted to the scriptures. They've been attracted to the story of Moses and the patriarchs. They're drawn to the image of community based on ethical standards of the Ten Commandments and so on. Yet they haven't become full members of the community because there's a high bar of entrance. They don't perhaps want to get circumcised. They perhaps don't want to follow the food laws. They don't want to observe the Sabbath in exactly the ways that the Jews are doing. So there's some barriers. But this is the community that the gospel took root in very quickly. Lydia, for example, is a God-fearer. She's a non-Jew who is part of the Jewish community, and that's where the gospel took root. And so there's a demographic, kind of sociological element to what's going on as well in this story. And here in Acts chapter 18, there's a reference to this guy called Titius Justus, whose house is right next to the synagogue, and he's called a God-fearer, a fearer of God. And that's just another example of this phenomenon of people who are already kind of in the circle. And it just makes me think about how God is preparing whole groups of people, whole sectors of society, demographic groups maybe. And we may not even know that God is at work in that group, and yet that's where the gospel takes off. That's where it connects. And it makes me wonder about how that's happening in the world today, in our communities. Who are those communities that are ready to receive the gospel for all kinds of reasons? And it's going to take off there in ways that we hardly even anticipate. Now, I know I'm running out of time, so I'm just going to just have one more kind of broad thing that I'm going to say. Are we doing okay, Dean? And that is, this story is full of politics. Did you notice that? There's politics absolutely all the way through the story. And I thought, when one comes to this part of the world, one should talk about politics a little bit. So the very first sentence of this story talks about how Priscilla and Aquila are in Corinth because the Jews have been expelled from Rome. Did you notice that part? The Jews have been expelled from Rome because of political stuff that's going on. And the Romans, like many polytheists in the ancient world, were always scapegoating, finding people to blame for stuff. In polytheistic society, when something bad happened, you thought someone's made the gods mad. Think about the story of Jonah in the boat when a storm came up and they thought, this is bad, someone's done something, who was it? Was you? You're out. And they kick them out of the boat. Well, that's what the Romans did. They would identify usually groups of foreigners that were sort of identifiable and you could sort of manage it and kick them out. If there was plague, if there was some kind of disturbance, if there was a drought, if there was a defeat in battle, whatever the thing was, people looked for someone to blame. And there is a high possibility that the disturbance that caused the Jews to be expelled from Rome this time, we learn about from the Roman historian Suetonius, that says in the 40s, there was a disturbance caused by someone called Crestus. Now, many historians think that he just mistook the name. The disturbance was really about someone called Christus. One letter difference, but you go from Christus, an ordinary name, to Christus, and that's the Latin word for Christ. And that it was, in fact, early Christian missionaries in Rome, perhaps Priscilla and Aquila themselves, preaching the gospel in Rome, that's caused a disturbance, and that disturbance has caused the Romans to say, you're all out of here. So there's a political setting that causes turmoil, that causes fear, that causes consternation. So that's one of the things that's going on. And the Jewish community and the Christian community, by extension, were always in a vulnerable position, always susceptible to random political action against them. But here in Corinth, when the Jewish community there, the unbelieving, hostile Jewish community, they try to use Roman law against the Christian community. They take them before Gallio, the proconsul, before a tribunal, and they try to use Roman law against the Jews, against the Christians. In this particular case, Gallio says, look, you're not talking about Roman law. They kind of present it as if they're breaking Roman law. But he says, you're actually just talking about your own law. I'm not interested in this. And he throws the case out of court. And it shows you that at least at that moment, the Romans are not particularly knowledgeable about the Christians as a separate group, and they're not interested in getting involved in communal politics. But that would change. 50 years after that, there would be a very different situation when Christians wouldn't just get, you know, the courts wouldn't just throw their cases out of court. But it shows constant turmoil, constant shifting. And that leads to an atmosphere of fear, of anxiety, of difficulty. And Paul himself is subject to that. And so it's fascinating that in this passage, Paul is given direct divine comfort when the Lord speaks to him in a dream and says, don't be afraid. Don't stop speaking. I am with you. You're not going to get hurt. I've got people in this city. And to me, that is one of the wonderful, encouraging things about this passage, is that Paul, in the midst of his own anxiety, receives confirmation from the Lord that the Lord is with him. But notice how there's an echo in that passage, in the promise that's made to him, of the Great Commission itself, where the Lord said, you know, go and make disciples all around the world, and I am with you always. And so this is an individual kind of reaffirmation of the Great Commission. I am with you always. But notice how it says, I am with you always, I'm with you now, I have got many people in this city. God's presence is mediated through his people. And it's remarkable that it says, I've got many people here, but there's not that many people that Paul knows about. Not that many people have been noticed, which just tells me that God is at work in ways that we aren't even aware of, that there are people that are God's people in the cities that will come to light as they're needed, as God draws them into the work that's being done. It reminds me of when Elijah, long before, after he had done battle with the prophets of Baal and Jezebel and all of that. Remember that afterwards, he's in the desert on the mountain, and he's discouraged and he's kind of losing heart because he says, "I'm the only one that's left." And God reminds him, "On the contrary, I have 7,000 people who haven't bowed the knee to Baal." And even Paul could be discouraged and needed to be reminded, I have many people in the city. Years later, when Paul wrote to the Corinthians, he reminded them that when he was with them in those first early days, he didn't preach in eloquent ways. He wasn't some grand speech maker. He says, I was with you in the power of the Holy Spirit, but also I was with you in fear and trembling. And so faith and fear go together. It's not as if you have faith and you're not afraid anymore. Paul was urged to don't give up, don't start, don't stop now. I am with you always. I have many people in this city. So friends, those are just some of my reflections on this story. I hope that you'll be able to think of ways that it resonates with you, that God's work is at world off in the world. God is at work in ways that are outside of our direct view. God has people in this city. God wants us to keep working in just ordinary ways. This is an ordinary story, essentially. That's kind of the point that I want to make, is that there's networks, there's demographics, there's people traveling, there's people who know each other, and yet God is at work in these ordinary things, and God's kingdom is being built. The work is being done. The seeds that are planted in these early days would continue to bear fruit for generations. And here we are, thousands of years later, reading these same stories and gaining insight from them. So, friends, don't give up. Don't lose heart. God has many people in this city, and God is with us. He's with you as we continue to be faithful to Him. Amen.
Holy, holy.